All right, everyone, let's do this. How are you? Welcome to this week's episode of our podcast. It's called Is Breakfast Included? Thanks for stopping by. On the show this week, I talk with Joanne Croxford. Joe does a lot of different things in the touring music industry. I've worked with her for a few years. She's a tour manager, production coordinator, hospitality, wardrobe. She does it all, and she's excellent at everything she does. We got into a little bit about where she's from, how she got into the business. She talks about her sobriety, being responsible for the first sober table at the TPI Awards this year. She's going to tell you all about that, what the TPI Awards are and how she did that. She's also going to talk a little bit about what she likes for breakfast. It was a great conversation catching up with her. Let's check it out. Okay, tell everyone who you are and what you do.
Okay, so I love this question already. So my name is Joanne Croxford, if we're being posh about it. And I am a tour manager, tour coordinator, and someone who just looks after people and loves doing that. I tour the world with bands that I love. I have some amazing friends who I tour with. And I'm an advocate for sobriety and recovery in live touring. Right on. That's me in a nutshell.
Where are you from originally?
So I was born in Canada, hence my lovely little twang. Not far from where you're sitting right now, actually, B. So I was born in a small kind of like farming community in a place called Chatham, Ontario, which is like, if you've toured Canada, like it's essentially between Windsor and Toronto on the bus. And like all you would know is that there's a stop to go. There's like a Tim Hortons there. That's all you'd know. You'd like come off the road and you'd see like, and all of my friends who used to work at Tim Hortons actually in high school used to say things like, oh, so-and-so came through on their tour buses last night. And I used to be so envious because I never worked at that Tim Hortons. And that was like the closest contact that I had with the music industry when I was a kid. It was so far away in my mind and in my my realms of possibilities that it's amazing that I'm here right now and doing what I do. It's really amazing.
As a kid, other than listening to music, were you involved in anything musically? Did you play? Were you a fan of music?
Oh my gosh. So, I mean, I was born listening to music. Like my mom actually gave birth to me when music was happening. But, you know, I have had some amazing experiences when I was younger because my parents are both immigrants from England. They emigrated to Canada before I was born. And what they would do is they're such travelers, they're really nomadic at heart. They would say, my dad would wake up, like, especially with the summer holidays being as long as they are in Canada, he'd say, let's drive to Florida. And we'd take a week on the road, waking up at 5 a.m. And in that time, I had the best education for music. So it was like U2's Joshua Tree, one of the most important albums of my life. That album, I grew up to that literally in the car. And, you know, all of these bands that my parents grew up on, they gave me such a healthy buffet every day, just driving for, you know, like we do on tour, you know, driving for like 15-hour days every day. And then we'd get somewhere when it got dark and we'd go to sleep and then we'd get up again and drive. So this kind of nomadic lifestyle is something that's so normalized to me, but it always had a soundtrack to music. And in my house, you know, people like the Beatles were talked about a lot. Elvis was talked about a lot. You know, I grew up on a very healthy serving of Motown, being so close to Detroit too. So, and my parents are just super, super musical. And it's so funny, since coming into touring, my dad said to me a few years ago, you do know that I wanted to do your job. And I said, what did you mean? He said, I really wanted to be a roadie. He said, I really wanted to do that. So you're living the dream that I always wanted. So it's always been in my surrounding and in my life that music is more important than anything. And that's why I sold my soul to rock and roll a long time ago, basically.
Right. I agree. I agree. How did you end up? You're in England now.
I am. I'm in London. Yeah, that's right.
How did you make your way to London and how did you get into this business?
Ooh, it's a great question. So I decided, like, when I was young, I think my first thought of I'm going to move to England was when I was 13. I went to Reading Festival and I saw bands like the Manic Street Preachers. I saw, you know, all these bands and I just knew I needed to be where that was. I was like, this is my home. This is my calling. I need to be where these musicians are. I need to be there. So the day I turned 18, I moved to England. I was so lucky. I had dual citizenship. So I had that, you know, that's a real privilege. And I recognize that, to have two passports. So I moved on over to England, and I actually lived in Reading because of the festival. No other reason. I thought, well, Reading's a good place to start. And I was going to art school there, and I got a job working at what was called a Virgin Megastore, which was like a record shop.
Yeah.
And I was in charge of vinyl. So 12-inch was my kind of baby. And that's kind of how it started, really. And I just hustled from there, really, Bernie. That was what it was. You know, the hustle. I got the hustle on, and then I moved to London about kind of 6 months later. And then I started working in fashion for a few years. And it was like, I always wanted to be in music. By this time, I was, you know, going to a lot of clubs. Like, there was a lot of, like, the grime scene in London was just emerging. So I was kind of enveloped in the grime scene, the drum and bass scene, like these really, like, grimy, gross raves that, like, nobody else wanted to go to that you'd hear about on pirate radio stations. Like, mm-hmm. That was where I wanted to be. It was like, for me, it was like a real punk movement. It was like real DIY. You know, people saying there's a party on here, come here. And, you know, you'd show up and there'd be like, you know, a PA system and no toilets because it was just like so grimy. You know what I mean? But I loved it. And I just knew I needed to be with the music. I knew I needed to be in live. And I kind of got infected there. And then just by chance and by luck, how these things sometimes happen in this business, I was tired of my job in fashion and I wanted to go and work in music. And I just so happened to, back in the day when people used to hire people from agencies, I joined an agency that kind of specialized in recruiting for the music industry and for kind of media, basically. And I went to an interview at a music management company called IE Music. And IE Music are, it's so funny, Bernie, because I walked in, I'm just literally remembering, I'm recalling as we're talking about it. I walked in that day and I thought, I'm going to be the receptionist here. That's what that job was for. So, and I was honored to have been given the job as receptionist there. And IE Music at that time on their roster, they had Robbie Williams, who's obviously a very big pop star in this country, a complete nobody in America, which suits him fine.
I hear that's why he lives here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's exactly why he lives there. You know, being with him in London versus being with him in LA, two totally different things, as they often are. But when I was working at IE Music, you know, as a receptionist, I kind of worked my way up and I was meeting all these amazing people, including tour managers, production managers, and I was a part of Robbie's, I was essentially assisting his director of special projects. So if he had like music videos he was doing, I was going on the road and helping to get like live stuff. So I was parachuted in and out of tours, but an artist that I was really heavily involved in is an artist that no one had really heard of at that time, but she's now become a household name, is Sia. I had mm-hmm. the real honor of working with, you know, with Sia. And, you know, I was thinking about it the other day in that job when I was working on reception, you know, she bought me a badge maker to make her first merch as a solo artist. So, you know, I pressed about 500 badges, gave myself blisters on my hands, but it's like, that's the scene I come from. I come from the DIY punk scene. So it was something that I knew. And I remember getting her first t-shirts made and going and selling them at her show in Shepherd's Bush Hall, which is just up the road from Shepherd's Bush Empire. I think we had maybe 50 people there. And now she's become like this big superstar. But it was just to kind of give you a context of the time, I was managing her MySpace page. That's how long ago it was. Yeah. It was like that long ago. But she's such a personality in that she engaged with her audience from such a young time. And she had like a message board on her website that her fans would engage with her. And she had me on there engaging with them too. So it was like, that was my first kind of exposure to working closely with an artist, engaging with their fans, but also kind of trying to understand the best way to support them. And just having, I had a great time. What an amazing job, you know? Yeah. And then.
Quick question. Who are her top eight friends on MySpace?
That's a really good question. Oh my God. So the one I do remember is Harmar Superstar was like her number one for a long time.
Yeah.
She was such good friends with him and he was such a legend and they did a lot of writing together back in the old days. But that was always a big move when she was like, oh, can you change my top friends? And I was always like, whoa, there was always like people saying like, what? She's changed the top friends or, you know, but just watching and kind of seeing really be how overnight, once her song was synced on 6 Feet Under, you know, Breathe Me was synced on the last ever episode of 6 Feet Under, just seeing how her MySpace plays went from like 1 million to 14 million overnight, you know, it was just like, all of a sudden she was on fire. And I was a part of that journey at that time and just kind of being there on that trajectory with her and, you know, witnessing her headline her first American tour, you know, all these things. It was just, it was incredible. And that's how I started. And I just, I made myself I made a name for myself by being myself ultimately. And that's what's kind of stuck with me. And I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, you are a presence.
Thank you.
Anyone who meets you remembers you. And, you know,
that's an honor.
You do present yourself in a way, in a good way. was that, did you tour with Sia?
So I was kind of, we didn't like go on the road for weeks and weeks and weeks, but I was kind of at shows where I was needed, basically. Yeah.
What was your first road tour?
So my first road tour was Robbie Williams, the Close Encounters tour, which was, so I was 21 or 22. And that was the first time I properly went out on tour.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite an eye opener because, I was with the artist. So I was touring with the artist party. So it was very different from a lot of other people who come into the industry who, you know, maybe get into a splitter van tour. I was in buses and planes pretty much straight away. So, I actually find it challenging to do things that are smaller than arenas. I find it's almost like I that's not my gift. That's not my language, but I know that it's all kind of universal. But for me, I just know my sweet spot is there because that was kind of like my entry, you know, mm-hmm. playing it. If I think of like venues that we played on that tour, so we played the Velodrome in Berlin, you know, that's like a massive sporting arena. And those are kinds of my places. That's like my temples, my churches, where I feel the most at home whenever we go into arena when we're playing. It's like, it reminds me why I sold myself to rock and roll so many years ago, basically.
Right. And what was the biggest surprise when you went on tour? Very much like you, I started on a bus as well.
Yeah.
I started on a bus and then was on a bus and then finally got on a tour that was in a van, you know, with trailer and I saw both sides, but I didn't see the van tour till middle of my career. So what was it like with you? Because I think your career has been the same way. You started on buses and planes, and then you've made your way into all aspects of the touring.
Yeah,
it's the biggest eye opener on tour for you.
I think the biggest eye opener is the lengths that people go to get the job done. And I mean that with the most humility, but also it shocks me sometimes how much people are willing to sacrifice of themselves in order to do this job. And it just reminds me how much passion is involved. You can't just do this because you got nothing else to do. You have to really love this job because it's, you know, it's boots on the ground. Like you have to be there. Whatever happens, you have to make the best of it. And I think that's why I personally approach this job like a lifestyle, because it is a lifestyle.
It is a lifestyle.
Commit to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the countless episodes I've heard of this podcast as well, where people have said similar. It's like, you don't just, it's not one foot in, one foot out. It's like, you're in this.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not, there's times when we go into a venue and it's, everything works the way it should. You're in, you're out. But then there's times where we're up for 22 hours.
Yeah.
To make
yeah.
an out, a 90 minute show happen.
Yep. Yep. And you try and explain that. And it's, you know, you and I did a show together a few years ago, British Summertime, and I was up for 27 hours that day.
Yeah.
Just trying to make the guest list work for the artist's family. You know, but you just do, you don't. And this is the beauty also of our jobs. I never look at the clock. The only time I look at the clock is when I know show's coming and when we're finishing. That's the only time when I'm like, okay, so that's when I'm conscious of the time. Obviously, I try and plan it so that I can kind of have some idea of how the artist's movements are, because that's my job. But other than that, I don't. And what a joy to have a job where you're not clock watching, because that would suck.
Yeah.
That would suck.
Let's talk about that a second. You just brought that up. Guest list. Since you're someone that handles guest list in this, and a lot of folks that listen to this podcast, I'm sure you get the call. Hey, can you get me on the guest list? Explain how the guest list works. Explain how we have no control over it.
That's all you need to explain, is we have no control over it. Numbers are dictated to us and we fill those numbers the best we can, you know. And it's and it's interesting, isn't it, B, because it's a very precious thing, I think, to ask for guest list places. And I always, if I can, if I'm able to, I buy tickets, because I believe in our industry and I try and, you know, support the artist. but there are instances where you need to ask for guesses, but just don't take the piss. It's all I'd say, you know, don't just get guesses because you want to feel important or it's ego driven. If it's ego driven, don't bother. Basically, that's what I say a lot of the time, you know. But of course, if I've got it, I will give it to people. Absolutely. But also something I would say that kind of tags along really nicely to this is don't just be fair weather friends with people when you want to be on their guest list. Like, this is a family. What we do is like, we are a family or we are one, you know, keep tabs on each other, check in on each other. You know, you don't just have to like hit someone up when someone's in town with a band. Like, you know, this is a lifestyle that we all choose. And it's important that we make time to keep those relationships going and don't just make it about being that guestless person, because I've certainly got people like that in my life. And I just, every time they inquire, you just think, oh my God, roll your eyes again. We must be in so-and-so because so-and-so wants guest list.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I know it's, we've all been through that. We've all been through that. I know that coming out of the pandemic and a show was announced like right out of the pandemic. And then you heard from people you hadn't heard from in 2 years, you know?
Wow. But I just think the ever audacity.
Popular, the ever popular, how are you doing? Text.
And you're like, but I just, I get, do you know what it is, B? I really love connecting with real people.
Yeah.
And I love it when people try, you know, make an effort to connect. I think that it means so much more. And it also means your place on the guest list means more, because you want to see that, not just see the band, you want to see the person that got you on the guest list. Yeah. Like, that's awesome to even have like 2 minutes. And you've done that for me. You went out and picked my dad up from being in line in Toronto. You know, that's like, he still talks about that today. He's like, that guy Bernie was so cool. You know, you just think like, it creates an experience for everyone, right? Yeah. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. He felt so important, your dad.
Yeah, he did. He was like walking around like with a real sense of, you know, wow. And that's the first time in my life he's told me how proud he was.
No, oh, that's great, man.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it was incredible. It was incredible taking him side stage so that he could see some of the show. You know, he was so moved. I've never seen him moved like that.
Yeah.
It was incredible. It was a beautiful day. And those are the gifts that we get to give people of live music, you know. I don't know how we came from there to guest list, but there we are. We're here.
your sobriety is a big deal to you. It's totally. part of your identity as well. I know that when you and I met, we immediately started talking, or you were telling me about it, and I found it. So to hear someone talk about their sobriety, you hear every, you know, some folks will share it on social media. Today is my anniversary, blah, blah, blah. But to you, you live it every day.
Yes.
You know, why is it so important? Well, I know why it's important to you, but how do you maintain it? Let me scratch that question. How do you maintain your sobriety in an environment where sobriety is not, you know, it's not a priority?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great question, B. And, you know, we're lucky in that we work with people, certainly one person who's very vocal about their sobriety in a band that we work with. So, you know, I know that that is a privilege to have that, but I mean, it's really interesting. And that's, so that question, that feeling of isolation, I've definitely been on tours where I'm the lone sober person and everyone around me, as you say, it's not a priority for them to even give a shit if I'm drinking or not, or whatever I'm doing. And that's why, you know, during lockdown, it was great to, I met a really great guy called John Ostrid. John is front of house for John Legend. And we were both connected via a Facebook group. And I'd seen that he'd started a collective called Roadies in Recovery. And I love the premise of, you know, zooming in from anywhere in the world with other people in our business who get this, who are trying to stay in whatever 12-step fellowship and trying to stay, you know, on the straight and narrow while they're on tour. So he had started Roadies in Recovery in America. And I said to him, look, dude, we need something that's not at 1 a.m. on a Saturday morning, you know, this side of the world. So, you know, I think it was 3 or 4 weeks later, we founded the UK/European version of Roadies in Recovery. And it's such a strong group, you know, Bernie. And every time I go out on tour, no matter what time of day it is, we meet. So Roadies in Recovery meets 3 times a week, but we also have a women's meeting. We have an LGBT meeting. Usually every night when I'm out, there's a meeting for me to tune on into. So whether that's I've just come back from show and I'm jumping on, or I'm just about to go to show and I'm jumping on, or, you know, we've got a really active WhatsApp group as well. And if someone's having a bit of a skewy day or feeling a little bit You know, like they need to talk to someone. There's always someone on the other end of the phone who is a roadie that gets it.
Yeah.
And that's literally saves my life.
Is this group something like perhaps somebody that's in recovery that's not as vocal about it or just struggling? Is this someone that anybody can join?
Yeah. Any road person or, you know, roadie associated person in any 12-step fellowship can join. And, you know, your anonymity is very much observed. You can be as vocal as you want to about it. You don't have to say anything, you know, outside of the group. Everything that's talked about in the group stays in the group. And that's really important. We really value the, you know, the anonymous side of what we all do in all the different 12-step fellowships.
Yeah.
So, but there are a few of us who are very open, like myself, and prepared to talk about our journeys, because, you know, if I talk to newer people in certainly in the industry and also in their recovery, they find it really encouraging to see that other people can do this, because you can be it if you can see it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really, really important thing. And I think, you know, going back to your earlier question, like why am I so vocal about my sobriety? Because my disease will tell me that I don't have a disease and I will hide. And if everyone doesn't know around me that I'm trying to keep myself well, my disease will be like, great, let's go and hide. I'm going to go and, you know, especially on tour B, you know, we know what it's like. You don't have any accountability to anyone. You know, nobody at home knows what you're doing. So it's like, it takes some serious discipline and really like making an effort and making a point of staying in touch and accountable with people. Because this is like the Wild West. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. And without saying any names, I know that Roadies in Recovery, before you and I knew each other, we had just met, and I heard from a friend that said, hey, I hear you're going to be touring with so-and-so. Tell him I said hello. And I'm like, how do you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't till I came to you and I said, so-and-so told me to tell you hello. And there was another person that we know that was on tour with us. And they said, yeah. And it turns out you were all part of Roadies in Recovery. And it was, and to me, I think that's why I gravitated towards you, because I was like, well, I know this person really well, and I know what kind of person he is. Of course, if he's, you know, that, I think that's why I knew you were a good person, because he gave you he vetted you.
But what a beautiful thing, though, to be associated with someone else who's a good person.
Yeah.
You know, that's great. That's all you want in life, you know, is like to be surrounded. And that's why I love touring with people that I feel that way about as well. It's like, you want to be surrounded with great and have a great time and do great things. And, you know, and Roadies in Recovery is a part of that. And, you know, we had so many people come through the door that's, you know, for whatever they need to be in the door for, but like staying sober for like 4 years, like since the like group began to now, they've managed to stay sober. And that is incredible. And they're still touring, you know, they're touring at, you know, on the road pretty much all the time.
Yeah.
And you just think like something is working, and the 12-step fellowships of people, you know, in the audience don't, you know, perhaps in the know of the something that we do is we say we keep what we have by giving it away. And service is a very big and important part of what we do. And I certainly see a lot of the work that I'm doing kind of externally and like outreach. That's my service. It's service. Yeah. It's being of service to other people, so that even if just one person goes, okay. That's given, you know, I've got that in my awareness now, or I'm going to join, or I'm going to tell someone about it. That is like mission complete, you know, and it helps my recovery too. So, yeah.
Have you ever been on tour and someone come to you and say, hey, I know you're sober. I'm trying. Has anyone approached you? Like,
I've had it many times, not just either from the touring party, but like venue staff, like a lot of people. Have just found me randomly on LinkedIn or on social media and said, hey, but it happens a lot in person. I get a lot of people saying, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? And there's like a certain look in their eye that, or someone close to them needs help too.
Yeah.
And they come and seek me out. And, you know, that's also a part of service.
Yeah.
You know, I always signpost them to the places that they need.
Yeah. Well, I do know you're an easy person to talk to from the get-go,
Thanks, B.
Yeah. You've always been, you know, and you're always aware on the road coming to someone saying, hey, are you okay? I noticed you're a little quiet today, you know? So
it's important. It's important. And I know that you do that for me as well. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, and that's how we can pick up on whether someone's actually okay or not. It's like, this is a bit out of character for you. Are you okay today? Like what's happening?
Yeah. Also, you're a big proponent of a LGBTQ community.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm very openly, I'm a queer woman. So that's something that I, you can't be if you can't see it. I'm very open about, you know, my place in the LGBT community. And I've got, you know, do a lot of work around trying to like rip the gate off of gatekeepers who are trying to keep the industry like one way. And I think, you know, I saw a meme the other day and I just thought that's so great. You know, the worst thing that you can hear, the worst five words you can hear in business is we've never done it like that before.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it's about inviting new people in and inspiring new people. And, you know, a lot of artists are actually asking, they're like pro queer spaces. So they're inviting and they're asking for, you know, queer crew, which is incredible. You know, why wouldn't you want to create a space around people that where they feel comfortable? Because as we say, touring is like a challenge.
Yeah.
It can be challenging.
Have you seen more representation in the touring industry?
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure, definitely. With especially after lockdown, all of a sudden there were loads of people who, you know, found their voices in whatever way that looked like. And it's so nice because I'm often not the only solo rainbow in whatever like setup we're in. Do you know what I mean? Which I love. But I mean, I also don't mind being that solo rainbow either, because if someone else sees me and it's like, well, she's pretty open with who she is in whatever way it inspires people. That's great. You know? Yeah. But it is an industry that is largely white cis het guys. Ultimately, you know, that's changing. It's changing. It absolutely is. But it's also about bringing people along with the change rather than saying and pointing fingers and it's not a witch hunt. You know, I think that's a really important thing. And that's what I'm really mindful of when I'm vocal about those changes as well. It's like, I like to bring people with me. Nobody should be cast out because of who they are, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do see on some of the tours that I've been involved in, it's not a matter of, we don't want you. It's a matter of like, well, you haven't been here, but now you're here. And it's a very welcoming industry.
In my
experience. Now, there may be some tours that aren't very welcoming, but the ones I've been involved with are very welcoming, you know? And it's not even a matter of being welcoming. It's a matter of being like, can you do the job?
Exactly. Know? Okay, other things that you are. Exactly. Can you do the job? That's all that matters.
Yeah, we don't care what you believe. We don't care what you identify as. Can you do the job? And then that's all anyone can. Really, because ultimately, that's why we're all out here, to do the job. Right.
Exactly. And this is the thing, like you said before, like it usually is, we're all there to just make a 90-minute set happen. That's literally it. That is it most of the time. So it's, just getting the job done, basically.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to someone the other day about, there's a scene in the movie Rocky where he says, if you're training for a 45-minute fight, you have to train for 45,000 minutes. Mm. And pretty much, if we are trying to make a show, a 90-minute show happen, we have to prepare for that show for 90,000 minutes, which I'm exaggerating, but it does take, you know, 10 to 15 hours to prepare for that 90-minute show, to make sure it all goes well, to make sure that artist walks on stage, picks up an instrument, a mic, whatever they're doing, perform for 90 minutes and walks off like nothing, because they're not thinking about it.
No,
they're not. They have full trust in us that it's going to happen. And that's why,
what an honor.
You're right.
It's an honor.
You know, when someone asks me like, how'd the show go? I go, well, I didn't hear anything after the show, so I guess it went good.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the same. It's like, when you don't get any feedback, that's actually a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I always encourage artists and crew that I work with as well to give me, you know, constructive feedback. But when you don't hear anything and when you just know that it's seamless for them, that journey for them is seamless.
Yeah.
I think that is the biggest honor, to be able to orchestrate that. We're very, very, very lucky.
Yeah. How do you relax on tour?
I exercise. Exercise is my relaxing.
Yeah.
So I've really gotten into swimming, like really into swimming. I was really into running for a few years, but I'm really into swimming now. And I swim, and I go to meetings when I can, 12-step meetings when I'm off. try to get to as many in-person meetings as I can. That's always a great way to just kind of get out of the touring bubble as well, finding local people and just like focusing on something else for an hour, whatever it is. That's really great. And I'm really into crocheting when I have my crochet hook with me. So I'm like crocheting on the road. And I also love sleeping when I can. But exercise is my thing. Exercise is like totally. Yeah. That's what keeps also my recovery. I need that. That's like my daily go-to is exercise.
I love to sleep.
Oh my God.
I love to sleep.
Kevin. You know what the best part is though? Like when you come home from a tour and that like week when you first get home, you can just be a snail.
Yeah.
You literally get in bed and you're just like, that is it. You get like shit delivered to your door. I mean, this is how I do it anyway. I go to the gym pretty much straight afterwards, but I'm like, I can just relax and sleep because it's like mission accomplished. You're like, oh, we did that great thing. And that was awesome. But now I can rest.
Yeah. Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
Only I do it on tour as well. on days off, I tend to stay in my room and just sleep, you know, because I love to sleep. If I'm not sleeping, I'm taking a nap, you know, like that's my motto.
What a great way to be though. Sleep is so good for you. And that's something I think I think as I've gotten older, I've realized like how much I love sleeping. And it's just something that we don't get a lot of opportunity to do on the road. So when it's there, it's like, I love sleeping on a plane. Sleeping on a plane. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was young, I worked with a gentleman and I want to say he was much older than me. He was probably in his late 30s. And I was young.
Ancient.
I know. And I thought he was a fossil, you know, but I remember he was having some kind of get together and he invited me over. We all worked at a grocery store. And then he said, don't come over too early because I'll be taking a nap. And I made fun of him. And he said, son, when you get my age, a nap is priority. And now I wish I could go back and tell him like, oh, you were so right.
Totally. That's like such wisdom. That's wisdom like that. Yeah. And that's good self-care. That's great self-care.
Yeah. 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 Let's talk about, you did something pretty cool recently. You were responsible for the first sober table at the TPI Awards. First of all, tell everyone what that event is and why it was so important.
So the TPI Awards is put on by a magazine called TPI Magazine, which is essentially like the Bible for everything backstage. So like touring, production, you know, all the big names are featured in there regularly. And like, if you're in there, that's like the bee's knees, right? That is like the magazine you want to be featured in. And they have an annual award ceremony. And, you know, historically, it's been a place where people go and it gets really, really messy. People get drunk, you know, they do whatever they do because it's the one time of the year when people are on tour so they can see each other. And I've known this for a long time, obviously having toured for a time, that it was a place where I mean, I hadn't felt comfortable going there before. That's something that I wanted to start with. And, you know, from my lived experience, if you want to change something, you do it. Basically, I thought to myself, okay, so how can we do this? So I approached TPI Magazine and I said, look, I've got this idea to have a sober table at the TPI Awards. And from what I understand, it's never been done before. And I don't know if it's ever been done at any award ceremony. I know that I certainly in this country award ceremonies are pretty hedonistic. And they were on board pretty much straight away. And they said, you know, obviously it's the first year and the table needs to be paid for. So I said, okay, no problem. That's a challenge. I love it when someone gives me a challenge. I'm like, right. Okay. So how are we going to do this? You know, and something that we say in recovery is like, you know, we enjoy the autonomy of recovery because we look after ourselves and we get the community to help. And that's what it's about. You know, we keep what we have by giving it away. Right. So I thought, you know what, let's just fundraise for this and let's see what happens. I put a crowdfunder up and I just press live and find people like yourselves believed in it and was like, okay, yep. You know, I got within the first 24 hours, we'd had an anonymous donation of £1,500, which is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
We managed to raise, it was £3,300. We managed to raise it in 6 days, which is just, again, it was just incredible. And the sober table was born. And then, you know, we slowly were working with TPI to get together like alcohol-free alternatives for the table. And slowly but surely, people were kind of cottoning on that this was happening. And a lot of people were really inquisitive about what was going to happen when we got there. So we got to table 126, which is now like a sober table at TBI Awards. And it was phenomenal. You know, we all sat there with our 10 bottles of water that we had, no, 20 bottles of water for 10 of us. And we all brought tea bags because we were all going to drink tea all night. But I didn't even get away from the table once because I had so many people coming to talk to me about it, which was incredible, you know, and extra, especially for me that night, as we rolled into the next day at midnight, I celebrated my 14th year in recovery. So it was like so unbelievable to be there at that very moment. And what was really beautiful was the person who got me into recovery, who unfortunately he died, his daughter was on the table with me and she gave me like my 14 year chip. So it was yeah, it was so, we both cried. We all cried because it was like, we really feel like the tide has turned in the industry to a place where you can say you're sober and people won't scoff at you anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah. And I appreciate that's not everywhere, but like the fact that TPI took this on and showcased it in the magazine also, they did an interview with me about it. I spoke about Roadies in Recovery, you know, about my journey. And as a result, I've had so many people reach out to me and say, what you've done is so important and please keep doing it, because they've wanted to go to the TPI Awards for years, but they don't drink for whatever reason. And they didn't feel comfortable going, but they said, now that we know there's a sober table there, we're going to come. So it's like automatically we've opened the gates for all these people who just felt like they weren't included.
Yeah.
And they are included. You know, they're part of the business like everyone else. They just happen to have a different lifestyle choice. So, you know, it feels like really incredible and important work to have done. And it was done because the community wanted it. And yeah. People like you put your hands in your pockets and said, you know what? I recognize this is important.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
It was a pretty big deal for you to take that on.
Yeah.
I mean, cause you can think like, you have to think like how many people have wanted this, but just have just said, well, there, it'll never happen.
Yeah.
And you did something pretty cool. That's going to carry on now.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. You know, and I said to TPI, as long as there's breath in my lungs, there will be a sober table there every year. Whether I'm there or not, I'm going to make sure it happens, whatever that is.
Is this something you'll have to pay for every year?
Who knows? I mean, ideally, I would love for a supplier to take it on and they just sponsor it every year.
Yeah.
You know, that would be fantastic because, you know, it's something that the community wants and they need. So, you know, to show real solidarity with people, I think it would be a great thing for a different supplier every year to say, we recognize the importance of this. We're going to pay for it this year. You know, that would be excellent. Like a rolling community driven initiative.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would be so great. And, you know, it's interesting just going back to being the person to make it happen. So many other people did things in increments to make me be able to get to a space where I could make it happen. You know, all the people before me, you know, I talk about in my interview in TPI magazine about, you know, IE Music, the company that I started in the industry. My old manager was a guy called David Entobe, and he was the managing director, and he got so many people into recovery. And I grew up in an office where we talked about therapy, we talked about mental health, we talked about all these things. And David used to go on the road with a production manager that you and I both know. And David would be the person that people go to if they had mental health issues or if they needed to go to rehab or all these things. And he just made it happen for them. So I feel like this work that I'm doing now is like carrying his name on, like carrying it forward.
Yeah.
Because he did so much of the prerequisite work. And another tour manager called Andy Franks as well, who's very open about his sobriety, you know, and Greg Dean, production manager that we know as well, very open about his sobriety. And these guys have been working for years to help make this happen. And I literally just went in with an idea and thought, well, this is what we're going to do. And we did it. So we all did it together. It was a house that was built by the community.
Yeah, right on. One question I should have asked you before we got into that. What triggered your sobriety, if you don't mind telling me?
Yeah, of course. So I actually lived in Berlin. So I moved to Berlin, gosh, when I was about, I got clean at 27. So I moved to Berlin probably about 26. And my addiction just got so bad. It got so bad. You know, I tried to drink myself to death in Berlin, actually. And I just came to a place where there were two options. There was either death or life. And my old boss, David, said to me, there's somewhere you've always been welcome, but you don't in 12-step fellowship, certainly we don't push you through the door. You have to want it, basically. And that was a Friday. And then on the Tuesday, I went to the first English speaking meeting of this particular 12-step fellowship that I belong to. And, you know, God willing, that's 14 years ago, 14 years and a month. And I had relapse is not part of my story, but I needed it. Otherwise, I was going to die. I was desperate. I was beyond, mm-hmm. you know, so if anyone comes to me on a tour or in, you know, at work and says, I need help, I'm obliged to help them because somebody yeah. helped me, yeah. you know, and it's changed my life. Basically. Yeah.
That's because I don't drink or anything. So I don't really, I'm sober because I'm sober. Like I just don't drink. I've never mm-hmm. drank. So, well, I'm not going to say I've never drank maybe once or twice, but
yeah,
I'm 53 and I'm pretty proud of that.
That's amazing, babe.
You know, but so cool. I never thought about that. It's not something we're going to push you through the door. You have to want to walk through, you know, mm-hmm. I never thought about that. It's something you have to want, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. I see
it's not
people,
just something you do regularly. Yeah. Yeah. On,
I see people yeah. struggle with it, you know, and it's to me, it's always, I respect those folks who, you know, who can hold yeah. on to it, you know, like yourself. Present company.
Thank
included.
You. Thank you. Well, same B, you know, you're also around it all the time, regardless of, you know, your status around anything. And where we are in an environment where drinking is certainly something that's, it's look at the majority of riders in our industry is like, there's an alcohol section.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, we're definitely in front of it. And the fact that you don't, that you're sober is incredible. It's incredible. Yeah. You know, it's totally not like other people. And I, for me personally, I think it makes you more employable because you're going to show up, you're going to do the job, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be of a present state of mind to actually be able to give the artist what they need.
Yeah.
I think it's a great thing.
What advice would you give somebody who wants to be in this industry, who wants to kick down the door or get their foot in the door? What advice would you give somebody?
Hustle. You got to hustle. And I wish that there was one answer, but I think everyone's journey is as individual as the individual itself. And I don't think there's just like one recipe that how it works. You know, I certainly know from my experience, like I was in a lot of places in the right time, but I was also open to it. You know, there's a lot of years where I didn't get into a situation where I wanted to be. You know, it's taken a lot of years to get to where I am now, to be in a position where I can be vocal about my sobriety and about, you know, being queer, but it's taken a lot of years. And you know, see every opportunity as a learning opportunity. You know, I do a lot of volunteering for a charity called Girls Rock London. And well, I certainly have in the past. And even that provides an opportunity for people to get their hands on instruments. You know, every opportunity is a great opportunity. And you just never know who's watching you work. So always work to the highest standard because you just never know.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
Where can people find you online?
Okay. So, I've got a website and the website is touringwithatwist.com, but I'm most active actually these days on LinkedIn, just Joanne Croxford on LinkedIn. That's the best place. I'm only on Facebook to look at videos of dogs, really. That's for the only reason. Pictures and videos of dogs. If you got those to send me, send them on over.
Dogs and cats.
Dogs and cats, any animals, really. I love animals. But yeah, in all seriousness, for like work-related stuff, and like I spend most of my time hanging out on LinkedIn these days, which is, again, totally interesting. That's the best place. And
I jumped on my LinkedIn page the other day and realized it's not the LinkedIn I joined. It's a completely different platform now.
Yeah, it's changed. It's really, I think that they've kind of modernized finally, because it just felt like a place where you'd buy like double glazed windows for a lot of years. You know what I mean? It was really like, well, a corporate, but it's not so corporate anymore because we're on there. So
yeah. Well, our podcast, first of all, I want to thank you for taking the time today. I know we've been trying to do this since
for years,
since we met. I've been and you've been just too busy. You're a busy bee. Our podcast is called Is Breakfast Included? And if we were having breakfast, Joe, what would you have?
Pink grapefruit in any shape or form is like my go-to for breakfast, whether it be in a juice or whether it be like in its raw form. Pink grapefruit just gives me life. And I'm really into like whole nut peanut butter. You can tell I'm vegan, can't you? It's like all the vegan dreams. And like a beautiful green-based smoothie of some sort, like juice, man. Anything with kale, you are singing from the same hymn sheet as me. I love that's my breakfast, like super healthy.
Right on. And I know this because I watched you eat breakfast for several months.
Exactly. You know that this is how I eat.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking time today. It was a pleasure talking to you. I'm sure everyone's going to enjoy this conversation because you're such a likable person.
Oh, thanks. You too, B. That's why we get on so well.
Right on. Joanne Croxford. Man, that was a lot of fun catching up with her. Don't look for her online. She's really not there unless you go to LinkedIn. Joanne Croxford. I don't know how you search for people on LinkedIn, but that's where you're going to find her. She's probably one of the most real people I've ever met. She's very serious about sobriety, about acceptance, about mental health. And that's really needed in this day and age. Don't forget to check out our web store. Our website, excuse me, is breakfast.com. You can link to our store, our YouTube, all of our podcasts, the Anchor and so forth. Check it out. Buy a shirt, subscribe, comment, leave some good comments about me and Lisa. You know, tell us how good we're doing. We need that sometimes, guys. We need it. All right, guys, I'm done. Have a great day. We'll talk to you next week.